If I could just make an announcement at the beginning, I think that it's the general expectation that any major research papers can be asked for by the day in the week during the exam week that the class would ordinarily be held. I would like to ask people to make every reasonable effort, those of you who are writing the longer papers, to have the paper in by a week from today. And if you want to make an unreasonable effort, I would not stop you. despite everything that I've said, it would greatly help my own process of getting the grades done before Christmas, which I'd very much like to do if possible. Okay. Today I'm going to move directly into number 12 on the outline and skip the review because I'd like to finish the material that I promised we would do at the beginning, and I think the only way I can do that is by moving straight into the question of discernment. I would recommend to you an article that appears in the latest issue of Theological Studies by Joseph Leinhardt on discernment of spirits in the early church. It's an excellent scholarly study of the use of the term discernment of spirits and the use of the term discernment without the qualification of spirits. In the patristic literature. I'm not going to be going into that dimension of the tradition of discernment, but the article is excellent. It's very readable, and it seems to me to be very well researched. He makes the point in there that the earliest literature on discernment, down at least through Origen, and I think perhaps a little bit beyond, always uses the expression discernment of spirits and is referring to the discernment of the movement of the evil spirit and the good spirit, where both of those are acknowledged as realities quite distinct from the person who is being represented, the evil spirit being demons and the good spirit being either the spirit of God or the angels of God. So that the expression has that meaning in the earliest centuries. Later on, the expression is simply discernment. The word that's used is simply discernment in some of the literature. And the question is left open as to whether or not the writers are referring to the influence of good and evil spirits. In other words, the word is used more to mean something like prudence or psychic self-knowledge. And the whole question of the influence on our own hearts from spirits other than ourselves is left more ambiguous. And Leinhardt makes the point that today we are confusing the language. And he suggests that we make clear what we're talking about, and that we make clear whether or not when we talk about discernment we are talking about the influence of good and evil spirits, or are we talking about prudence under the influence of grace. And he's just saying that our language is a bit cloudy on this issue today. Now, what I'm going to be discussing in class today is not going to take into account the influence of good and evil spirits, and particularly of evil spirits on us. But that doesn't mean that I, relegate that belief in the Christian tradition, to myth. I don't. I do not. It's simply something that I'm not going to enter into at this point. I think that there is a real dimension of discernment that has to discern the influence of particularly the evil spirit upon us. And I think the deliverance ministry that is being exercised in the church today is in contact with that reality and is aware of it. And I personally put credence in that reality and in some at least of the dimensions that are coming out of the deliverance ministry. But I'm not going to enter into that in the discussion. I'm going to be talking about discernment along the lines of the discernment of the will of God under grace, under the influence of grace, and simply bracket the question of the influence of spirits hostile to God on us, simply bracketing that, but not relegating it to myth. I don't. So, our discussion last week of Kierkegaard helped us move our discussion beyond the ethical consequences of the polarity of limit and transcendence. We've moved beyond that. That's mainly what we were talking about when we talked about Jung, were the moral consequences of the polarity of limit and transcendence. Kierkegaard moves us beyond the moral into the religious sphere of existence. And now the question that I want to ask today to tie this lecture to last week's is the following one. What precisely does it mean to experience oneself as grounded transparently in God? What is that experience? It's Kierkegaard's definition of faith. That the self, in being itself and in willing to be itself, is grounded transparently in God. All right, what is the experience of being grounded transparently in God? I think that question opens us upon the question of the discernment of God's action in our lives. Okay, now under number 12 on the outline, the first point that I have there is the roots of the tradition of discernment. The explicit tradition of what we have come to call the discernment of the will of God finds its roots in pre-Christian history. What today and what for centuries we have called discernment of the will of God reaches back beyond Christianity, that whole effort. And it reaches at least to the pre-Christian development of consciousness that we have come to call the axial development of consciousness. A number of authors have discussed the axial development of consciousness, and the two that are most influential on my thinking about it are Carl Jaspers and Eric Vogel. But their thesis is that somewhere between 800 BC, and then the final date will differ from one author to another. Jasper says down to 200 BC, but that's because he doesn't take Christianity as seriously as he ought to. I would say down to 500 AD. So it's a long period of time. During those centuries, there is a movement out of mythic consciousness into some form of realism. Out of myth and into some form of realism. And that movement takes place simultaneously in many different parts of the world, and it seems that the roots of it, at least, happen independently in these different places. They're not influenced by one another, as far as we can tell, anyway. But some of the key instances of the axial development in Greece, you find it in the tragic authors of the tragedies, where mythic figures are used, but to express a development of consciousness out of bondage to myth and into a form of realism. And then particularly in the Greek philosophical tradition, where that movement is objectified, thematized, clearly. In Israel, you have, of course, the experience of Moses, which Vogelin, I think, correctly interprets as a movement out of the cosmological myths of Egypt and into history under the guidance of God. So you have the whole Exodus experience in Israel, which actually is earlier than 300 BC. But you have this movement particularly objectified in the prophets and in the wisdom literature. Beyond myth, into the real world. The ethical monotheism of the prophets, accent on social justice, and the wisdom literature and its accent on discernment of the will of God. In India, with the Buddha, whose main, one of the ways of talking about what the Buddha did, huh, is to purge consciousness of illusions and to bring it to harmony with the real order of things. And in China, the key figures are Confucius and Lao Tzu. Now, the movement is obviously different in each of these cases. But in all of them, what is common is that there is a break with a mythical way of thinking and a recognition of the exigencies of the human mind to deal with the data of reality as they are. Okay, now two aspects of this development are pertinent to the tradition of discernment. The first aspect is that with this development, the axial development, you have a clear recognition of a world transcendent reality that in the Western tradition we have referred to as God. That the conception, how that world transcendent reality is conceived, obviously differs from one tradition to another, but you have a clear differentiation of a world transcendent reality as a distinct sphere of being, distinct from anything within the world. And together with that, you also have the emergence of the significance of the individual willing to be itself, finding its way, the whole recognition of the search for direction in the movement of life that has to be carried on by each individual. In Plato's language, the soul of the individual is the source of order in society. And God is the source of order in the soul. It's a very succinct way of describing this development, that the emergence of the individual, that the integrity of the individual is the source of order in society, and God is the source of order in the soul. So God is... And I'll use the Western conceptions here, the Greek and Israelite conceptions. God is the ultimate source of order in reality. And God transcends all intracosmic reality. This is true both in Israel and in Greece. The God who is the source of order transcends everything within the world. But God is experienced as a movement within the soul. That draws us to attunement with himself. A movement within the soul, an inclination within our hearts, drawing us to attunement with this ultimate source of order. Now, in Greece, of course, God is less personal than he is in the Israelite tradition. So, but still, it's an inclination drawing us to attunement with the ultimate source of order. So the inclination to rightness in being that we feel. We all feel an inclination to be set at right, at rights in being. We all want to be on the right path. And with this axial breakthrough in consciousness, that inclination is recognized as an interior reality. There's a growth in the recognition of interiority. Interior reality is explicitly recognized as such. There's a movement in the inner being of each of us that inclines us to attunement with God. Being in harmony with the will of God in the Christian language. We have that inclination in our hearts. To be in harmony with God's action, with God's inclination, his movement, inclining us to himself. And so, in all of these traditions, you have the emergence of something that verges on what we have come to call discernment. The problem is this. In all of these traditions, you have the following problem. That each of us needs to discriminate those inclinations that draw us to attunement with God and those inclinations that draw us away from attunement with God. That's an awareness that emerges in the literature of all of these traditions. We need to discriminate between the inclinations in our hearts that draw us to the attunement with God and the inclinations that draw us away from that attunement. And that's the original emergence of an explicit tradition of discernment. Now, the language is going to differ, as I say, from one culture to another. One of these breakthroughs to another. The Buddhist tradition will not use the language of God, but it will use the language of discriminating illusion from truth. And the source there is, all right, what is in harmony with the ultimate reality? And what is not in harmony with the ultimate? Now, I would recommend to you, if you haven't read it already, it's a long paper by Vogelin called The Gospel and Culture. I've recommended it before. It's in a book entitled Jesus and Man's Hope. But Vogelin does an excellent discussion in there of the tradition of discernment as it appeared in Plato, and then through Plato in Greek culture. And he uses the language that he uses are the poles and counterpoles. Plato was aware, and he expressed it very clearly, that we need to discriminate poles and counterpoles. That is to say, the inclinations that lead us to attunement with God and the inclinations that lead us away from attunement with God. And the language that Vogelin uses to sum that up is the language of poles and counterpoles.
Does Vogelin tend to go mostly with Plato when he wants to pull ideas out of Greek philosophy?
Mainly, yeah. Vogelin's written two major books on the Greek tradition. The first one is The World of the Polis, and in there he's dealing with the pre-Platonic philosophical tradition. and his second one is called Plato and Aristotle, and the bulk of that book is on Plato. And then in his fourth volume of The Order and History, the first volume is on Israel, and the two on Greece, and the fourth volume is called The Ecumenic Age, and he deals with other aspects of Greek culture in that, as well as with India and China and some of the other things. And he's currently writing his fifth volume on modernity. But his main source for the Greek is Plato. He loves Plato. And he gives a very unique interpretation of the whole Greek philosophical tradition, namely that religious experience is at its origin. It makes a great deal of sense to me. There's a revelatory experience, and that Greek culture is a preparatio evangelica. It's a preparation for the gospel. Not to the same intensity as the Israelite history, but nonetheless, it's an interesting thesis.
Jesus,
you mean,
his hope is that?
It's edited by two people, Miller and Hadidian, H-A-D-I-D-I-A. It's a series of essays, and Bogman has one in there, Gospel and Culture. Yes.
The book isn't in the library, but Adam has an article on the
show. Oh, okay. Good. Thank you. Very good. On the reserve shelf. Okay, secondly, anthropological and soteriological components of the tradition of discernment. What I've given you so far of the tradition of discernment, namely as it is found in the pre-Christian literature, I would call, following Vogelin, I would call it the anthropological component in the tradition. Because the key to discernment, as we see it so far, the key to discernment is found in the movements in our own hearts by which God draws us to himself. And so and that's why I would go along with the term anthropological. Namely, we must investigate the movements in our own hearts, in the human heart. And that is the key. Those movements by which God draws us to himself. These movements are qualitatively different from every other movement in our hearts. Plato speaks of the golden cord, which draws us gently, whereas the other strings draw us violently. So it is a matter of discriminating the gentle inclination of the golden cord from the violent movements of the other inclinations. But at any rate, they're all aware of the fact, all of these key figures, that the movement to attunement is qualitatively different from every other movement of our hearts. And they're all aware that the individual person is responsible for discriminating between these various inclinations. Vogelin argues in the Gospel and Culture that Christianity could be preached successfully in the Greek culture precisely because this awareness was already developed. The culture, the seeds were already planted. Christianity could move out of Palestine and into Hellenic culture with relative ease. Of course, it was also an age of martyrs, as we know, but still, it took hold because there was already an awareness about the question that was alive in Greek culture. And his whole point in this article is that the question has died in our time. And before we preach the gospel, we need to resurrect the question. All right, the soteriological component comes with Christianity. It comes beginning in a beginning phase, I would say, with the history of Israel, but it comes decisively with Christianity. a distinct component in the tradition of discernment. And here's the way I would describe it, and this is my own work. This is not, Vogelin himself is not acutely sensitive to Christianity. He's more sensitive to it, much more than Jaspers is, but I think still not enough. So this is my own description of the soteriological component in the tradition of discernment. The world-transcending source of order, the Logos, has become human flesh. Has revealed a pattern of living and that pattern of living is the most complete realization of attunement with God. So we have a revelation of what attunement with God would be in its completeness. We have that revelation in the very Word of God become human flesh. The pattern of attunement with God is embodied when God Himself, the source of order, the Logos, assumes humanity. So to be in attunement with God is to take on the pattern that Jesus assumes in becoming human flesh. Attunement now becomes being made after the image of Jesus. To the extent that we allow ourselves to be made after the image of Jesus, we are in attunement with God. Jesus being the very Word of God, the revelation of what it would be to be in attunement with God. And that pattern, what is the pattern that he took on? It's not found explicitly in these other traditions. Certainly not with anything like the clarity that it appears in Christianity. It is the law of the cross. The pattern of attunement with God is the law of the cross in the face of the mystery of evil.